WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, the Senate weighs in on the U.S. war against ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. ISIS has money, a lot of money, an estimated $1 billion plus in assets. That makes it the richest terrorist organization in history. Now, the money comes from oil, from extortion, from hostage taking, money laundering, bank seizures, agriculture, and a lot more. ISIS runs like a huge conglomerate. It's got employees in hospitals and schools and utility companies. The U.S. has been bombing its oil facilities to try to cut off part of the cash flow, but ISIS is a multi-headed beast. This hour on Point, financing a terror operation and how to disrupt it. You can join us on air or online. Does ISIS, with all of its assets and cash flow, seem to you like a giant corporation? And are missiles the way to stop it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me from Washington is Louise Shelley. She is a professor in the School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs at George Mason University, where she's also a founding director of the Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center. She's author of a book that touches very directly on this topic. It's called Dirty Entanglements, Corruption, Crime, and Terrorism. Welcome, Louise.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Colin Clark. He is associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation, and he has been looking also at ISIS's financial network. Welcome, Colin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with this concept that this is the richest terrorist organization ever. Louise Shelley, is that an exaggeration?
It's not. The combined assets of the banks, the oil, and the diverse revenue streams of ISIS have made it extremely wealthy. There's nothing to compare with it in history previously.
How much money are we talking about, or how much wealth?
We're talking about $1 million a day in oil revenues, much of this done by smuggling oil to neighboring states. We're talking about money obtained from banks, from illicit trade in a variety of products, from selling of passports, selling of antiquities. It is a diversified criminal business and a diversified terrorist business at the same time.
Colin Clark, I mean, this is probably a pretty obvious question, but I'm assuming that having the wealth gives ISIS much, much more leverage in the world to do what it wants to do. I mean, money matters in this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a diversified portfolio. So if you target one aspect of ISIS's financing, it's likely to fall back or rely upon other aspects of how it brings in money, other revenue streams. The one thing I would say, though, is important to point out is that while ISIS is bringing in quite a bit of money, it also has a lot of money going out because of this state building project, its attempt to build up this caliphate. So we also have to consider the debits, which are quite substantial, that ISIS has as well.
Okay. I do actually want to get to the debit part of the conversation. But for the moment, let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of how they gathered all of this money. You know, you hear the term that a terrorist group is running an oil field. It just doesn't seem to compute. Where would they get the expertise? How would they know how to switch the thing on? Louise Shelley, how does that literally work?
We think of ISIS as a group of motley terrorists, but ISIS is a very complex organization. Much of its leadership comes out of the former Ba'athist government, the Ba'athists that were put in prison after the invasion of Iraq, met the insurgents, and formed this organization that's now ISIS. So we have people who are used to running the oil fields or know the people who ran them. We have the people who used to smuggle oil, and you can tap into these networks from the Saddam Hussein era because they were smuggling oil during the period of sanctions. So we need to be thinking of an organization that's really a multifaceted organization that has many individuals with sophisticated skill sets that can run oil fields and smuggling operations.
And Colin Clark, what Louise Shelley is saying is that if one has the impression that ISIS just went in and killed all the intellectuals and the smart people or imprisoned them or cut off their heads, that's not true, that actually they held out to keep themselves some technocrats on staff.
Yeah, we know that. So in what may be a sign that ISIS has learned from its mistakes in Anbar province during when the group was al-Qaeda in Iraq during the awakening, when ISIS did remove some civil servants from their leadership positions, it's now kind of compelled mid-level bureaucrats and technocrats to remain in their positions in order to ensure continuity. ISIS's use of former Assad regime loyalists displays a pragmatism that's been vital to its success holding on to territory that it has captured.
Well, what's the dynamic, say, in an oil ministry, for example, where somebody has some expertise that ISIS needs? Do they need to believe that guy in office 6B is a believer in the cause, or do they not care? Is he under duress? Is he basically a hostage himself?
Yeah, I think it's a form of inducements and coercion. So ISIS they'll typically take out some of the top leadership to instill their own folks, and then have the guys that know how to keep the lights on, in this case quite literally, stay in those positions. So that's something that ISIS will have to figure out over the long run, whether they want folks that are loyal to them or you know, at this point right now, I'm not sure they're as concerned if these are individuals that are staying because they're scared or because they're true believers.
Louis Shelley, this whole notion that they took over the Bank of Mosul, is that – I understand the haul was about $500 million worth in Iraqi dinars and gold. Is that correct?
There's some question of how much money was actually taken and how much was available. But there's certainly the ability to run these banks and to tap into a functioning financial system at the moment. I think there's one other piece that we need to be adding, which is the enormous amount of corruption that was existing in the region that has been taken over by ISIS under the Maliki government. And people were not part of the patronage system. Things were not functioning, which is why they did not put up resistance to ISIS. And it's part of the reason that people are ready to cooperate with this government, because they want things to run and they haven't been functioning for a very long time.
So right now for them, ISIS is looking like the lesser of two recent evils.
Absolutely. And if you're not the subject of its incredible violence, if you're not part of a minority, it is an organization that's delivering services and it's bringing back some of the Ba'athists that know how to run things.
Well, the whole issue has been getting a fair amount of media attention lately, this money and ISIS question, and I just want to take a little bit of a listen to what CNN had to say about it in a report back in October.
Want to do business in ISIS-controlled territory? You pay a tax. Want to move a truck down a highway? You pay a toll. Villagers in ISIS territory pay for just about everything.
Colin Clark, is that pretty much the picture of things, or is the population to some degree footing the bill for ISIS as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That is the case. ISIS extortion practices demand somewhere between 10% and 20% of revenue from businesses in its territories, and also operates other mafia-style rackets that help contribute to its coffers. It also couches its extortion-related activities in terms of jizya, which is a traditional tax paid by non-Muslims living in Muslim lands. So as Louise mentioned, start with some of the minorities first, and then extend your revolutionary taxes to others living in the area.
Well, nobody likes paying taxes, Louise Shelley. You were saying a moment ago that to a degree, the population considers ISIS the lesser of two evils compared to the authority that was in place before. But if they're being extorted this way and being forced to pay percentages of their salaries or tolls to go down the road, how long will it be before any goodwill wears off among the population?
If ISIS continues to deliver a modicum of services, people are ready to pay a certain amount of their income to have things function, and they haven't been functioning. And it's a different structure in which people are part of patronage networks. They're used to paying. It's not something we're accustomed to, but it's not out of character with what has been going on in this region for quite a long time.
I want to talk about how this oil thing actually works. The notion that they've got control of the fields and that the oil literally gets to market in the middle of a situation which is unquestionably unstable. I mean, if nothing else, the oil industry likes things to be stable. How does it literally function that the oil comes out of a well and gets to a market someplace? Colin Clark?
Yeah, so we know that a significant portion of the money raised by ISIS between, let's say, June and September of this year came from the group's capture of key oil fields and refineries in northeastern Syria, as well as parts of northern Iraq. Essentially, when you control territory, you also control the key arterial roads and the centers of commerce within that territory. And the smuggling of, and trafficking of oil, which is smuggled out in tanker trucks, is then sold on the black market in Turkey and Syria, including to elements of the Assad regime, that provides this group with, you know, with the money that it's earning.
They're selling oil to their enemies?
That's right. I mean, that's not terribly uncommon in conflict. We saw, we've seen similar things in the Balkans during that conflict with various sides fighting during the day and then trading and selling things to each other in the evenings. And we've seen it in Afghanistan as well with you know, formerly the Karzai government and elements of the Taliban fighting and trading at the same time.
And who are these truck drivers? Are they freelancers or are they part of the ISIS force?
I think the truck drivers are, you know, these are folks that are operating in the area. And so while I wouldn't call them part of the ISIS force, they're certainly willing to pay the tax to stay alive. And I think the truck drivers are key because if we can get a sense from the truck drivers how much they're being extorted, it can help us do a rough arithmetic to find out just exactly how much ISIS is bringing in on a monthly basis from this practice.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about ISIS's vast wealth and what the U.S. is doing or needs to do to disrupt its financial network. You can join the conversation. Is ISIS the new model for terrorist groups, diversified with a big organizational chart and social media savvy? We're talking with Louise Shelley. She is founding director of the Terrorism Transnational Crime and Corruption Center, and she's author of Dirty Entanglements, Corruption, Crime, and Terrorism, and also with Colin Clark. He is associate professor scientist at the RAND Corporation, who studies ISIS's finances, this issue getting covered a lot again from a CNN report that aired back in October.
U.S. coalition forces just in the past week have destroyed, attacked, and bombed ISIS oil facilities precisely to cut off the group's funding. But if you think just knocking out ISIS's oil will stop this radical Islamic army, you don't understand just how many ways ISIS funds itself.
Obviously sounding complicated, and we have a lot of people wanting to ask questions. Let's bring in Dorothy from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Dorothy, hello, you're on Point.
Hi, John and guests. I just heard that you just played a little segment that said that the oil fields have been bombed, and that kind of went to my question.
Mm-hmm.
If they're getting most of their funding or a significant portion of their funding from the oil facilities, why is the bombing of the oil facilities not cutting off that source of funding?
Excellent question, because it seems like it would be exactly the choke point that we need to be hitting. Louise Shelley, what about that?
There has been some hesitancy to bomb the fields directly, because the reconstruction of it will be so difficult. That lesson was learned in the earlier invasion of Iraq. So a lot of the focus of bombing efforts has been on mobile refineries as an effort to cut off the funding.
What does a mobile refinery look like?
It's a much smaller a piece of equipment that allows them to refine the oil on the spot. It's also a problem because the smuggling networks that existed before have been reactivated. And there is a lot of complicity in local governments. So that, for example, there has been press revelations in the Kurdish press of the high-level officials and government personnel who are helping to move this oil. So it's not so easy to just cut it off.
You had mentioned that these government officials who are working with the organization, that some of them were part of the previous corrupt Saddam Hussein regime. And, you know, no one's recollection is that people working for Saddam were particularly Islamist in their outlook. If anything, they were highly secular in their outlook. And Colin Clarkman, that seems to me like a recipe ultimately for disaster for ISIS if they're depending so much on former members of the Ba'ath regime as the linchpin for their money system.
I think certainly it's a marriage of convenience for the time being anyway. And one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about and talking a lot about with colleagues is that to the extent that we are successful in targeting ISIS's revenues from oil, this could cause the group to lean more on things like extortion, on kidnapping for ransom, on some of the more predatory methods of raising funds, which in turn could drive a wedge between ISIS and then local Sunnis in Anbar province in western and northern Iraq. We were calling it tentatively a kind of Anbar Awakening 2.0 of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Dorothy, thanks for your call. Let's bring in Hassan from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Hassan. You're on Point.
Hi, guys. Just wanted to say it's a great conversation. I've heard a lot of good insights. But my question is more towards like some of their more sophisticated collaborators. By that, I mean high-level officials in governments like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Qatar. I mean, we've always known that there's always been some level of support there, whether it's through financial, whether it's material or funds. And so, I mean, I kind of find it hard to believe that a couple of guys, who are, again, former Iraqi officials and things like that are just being able to, move around hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. Let's take that to Louise Shelley. You know, what Hassan's suggesting is that there's got to be help from the outside, and he's talking about usual suspects being perhaps Saudi Arabia, Qatar, countries like that. What about that? And is that a choke point potentially to be acting on?
I think it is. One of the questions we're not looking at enough is where the money is going, and one of the ways to get at crime and terrorist business is to follow the money. Some of it we know is going into Kurdistan, and I would not be surprised that it's going to some of the same places that the Kabul bank money went to, which is UAE, which makes it hard to recover. But there are established systems in the region of moving funds where people don't ask about it and where recovery is difficult. And I think that this is an important part of the story that's not coming out yet.
And Colin Clark, I mean, we know that Al-Qaeda, from which this group ultimately emerged, but the Al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden was a group that relied an enormous amount on outside donations. Bin Laden put some of his own money into it as well. Is that model in place here as well? I mean, it sounds to me more as though we're talking about a business enterprise than a charity. And I'm wondering if that's true, and does that make a difference in the ability to sort of strike back against it?
From my own research, that's one of the biggest differences we've found between ISIS and Al-Qaeda Central or traditional Al-Qaeda, the group formerly headed by Osama bin Laden, currently headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri, is that whereas that group was funded significantly from wealthy patrons or individuals from the Gulf states, ISIS relies much less on funding from abroad. They're far more locally sourced, which makes it more difficult to get at this money.
Why is that more difficult?
Because we need to start thinking more about local or regional economies than the global economy, which is what we're, used to thinking about. And we need to, especially with the oil, start thinking about targeting the middlemen, the traders, the refiners, the transport companies, all of which are going to be at a more regional rather than international level.
And I interrupted you when you were talking about basically the difference between the model that Al-Qaeda used and the model that these guys are using. I mean, how successful would you rate the West or the coalition, let's say, in its attempts to shut down Al-Qaeda financially over the last 13, 14 years?
Yeah, I think the West in general has done a really, really great job at targeting Al-Qaeda's finances, but ISIS has taken notice, which is why they've shifted to the different model that they're now following today. So success in one area breeds difficulty in another area, and that's playing out before our eyes.
Now, you mentioned before, Colin Clark, that ISIS also has bills to pay, and that as it aspires to establish itself as a state, a caliphate, as it says, that it's ultimately going to need to repair the roads and keep the electricity running, and that the day is going to come when it may face its own budget crunch. And we heard from a colleague of yours, not in your organization, but Tom Keating. He's the director of the Center for Financial Crime and Security Studies, left a note on our website about an article he wrote about this. And he makes the argument that ultimately the obligations that ISIS will be facing if it aspires to run things and deliver services is very likely to break it. They had a one-time windfall with capturing the oil fields and taking over a bank with $500 million in it, but that's not going to last forever. What do you think of that argument?
I know Tom, and I tend to agree with him in that respect. The larger and the more robust the group's infrastructure becomes, the more difficult it will be to maintain and to sustain moving forward, particularly as the group has to shift resources away from non-kinetic areas like infrastructure toward more kinetic areas, toward training and equipping its fighters, especially as fighters continue to flow into Syria and Iraq from abroad and from the region.
Louis Shelley, if we were successful in disrupting the oil supply, what impact would that have on our reputation in terms of hearts and minds of the people in Syria and Iraq who are now under ISIS control? Would they think, would they look at us as helping out their cause, or would they simply know that the lights went off and that we did it? And we've seen that happen before in 2003 when the U.S. invaded Iraq and the lights went off and the electricity stopped and the water stopped, and it caused enormous backlash against the coalition forces. Which do you think it would be?
Before we get to that, I want to say something about their financing. There's also in place a huge patronage system that is existing in ISIS-controlled territories that's also a drain on resources. So there is a burn rate for their money. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we're not talking about is what they may go back to generate money that's not just based on extortion. There's an old al-Qaeda model that existed and was used in Indonesia to help fund the Bali bombing. And what we're thinking about is a highly computer-savvy organization. Look at how they're recruiting volunteers around the world to come and fight with them. So they can use computer technology to get funding from supporters overseas, and they can resort to computer crime, not the sophisticated type of stuff we're seeing from some hackers, but fraud and other activities, which is an old al-Qaeda technique. So we need to be thinking about them as diversification, mm-hmm. and what they can do next, and not just in these traditional ways that they control this territory, and if you take away this on this territory, then they won't do something else.
Which actually puts the oil question a little bit lowers its prominence, then, it sounds like you're saying.
Yes. I don't think it's quite as central as we've made out. They are opportunists. They're going after the easiest thing, and if that doesn't work, they will diversify into all kinds of other smuggling activities as well. But let me get to this point about the community. Yes, if there are too many oil fields that are destroyed, that the lights go out, they will see that there is a lack of infrastructure that will be blamed on us, and ISIS won't have disappeared because it has an enormous capacity to diversify and generate revenue, and it's got support in from neighboring states that are participating in this smuggling. And so we are in a very risky position of going after one high-value commodity and not thinking about where this business may go and how it can diversify. And we're not talking enough to legitimate businesses that are operating in the region and are observing other illicit flows that are going on.
What is it that we expect of those other more legitimate businesses? What do we want them to do?
There are many legitimate businesses that are operating in the region, selling pharmaceuticals, selling cigarettes, selling other commodities, and they understand very well how some of these illicit flows are going on, and they could help be our eyes and ears on the ground. There have been indications in the past where this has been done, and we are not tapping enough into the expertise of the business community. And ISIS is functioning as a business, And we need business to help break a business. It's not just a question of a military approach. We need the insights of business. We need the techniques of business. We need the partnerships of business.
Let's bring in Sean from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Hi, Sean. You're on Point. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of bring this down a level and kind of mention something. So one thing that I do is I work as an OFAC analyst for a regional bank here in Connecticut.
I'm sorry. You work as a what? We missed you a little bit.
That's an OFAC analyst, which stands for the Office of Foreign Assets Control.
Uh-huh.
And basically what we do is follow all of the advisement of the Treasury Department, following the sanctions, sanction people on terrorist watch lists, try to keep them out of the financial institution. And one unfortunate thing that I've seen in this industry, it just kind of goes with the way things are, is we've worked toward what they call de-risking the banking industry and their business, their banks and their financial institutions, by saying, well, this person has Syrian citizenship. You know what? Let's not do that. Syrian citizenship, we don't want to have anything to do with people with that sort of citizenship because that's a risk.
So, Sean, off of what Louise was just saying about trying to recruit legitimate businesses, you're saying that what you're talking about seems to be something that's detrimental to that process.
I think that we'll see obvious things on the watch list, like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Boom, that's an easy one. We've identified him. He's not going to have an account with us.
Leader of ISIS.
There's also more of a broad reach going on, and it'd be nice to see that we can maybe identify things and say, well, these are the bad guys, these are the good guys, as opposed to such an overreaching marginalization of a large population.
Colin Clark, your response to what Sean is saying?
I think de-risking is a really tricky issue. One of the things that could result from this policy is what we call intel gain loss. So are we gaining more intel or losing it by, you know, forcing these individuals outside of the formal banking system? So restrictions on banks could essentially encourage terrorists to avoid the banking system. Some people argue that you actually want the money flowing through the system so it's traceable.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, then these banks are fined, not an insignificant amount of money. So really, you know, one of the things that I talk to folks about is in the United States, but also abroad, a closer public-private partnership to really make sure that that the U.S. government's on the same page as the private sector, as these financial institutions that we're kind of working toward a common goal, common objective.
Louis Shelley, would you say that ISIS, we've been talking about it, you know, this business model, is it a well-run business or is it just sort of muddling along?
There's nothing that can function in this conflict region extremely well, but it is doing as well as it can under the circumstances. If you can think that a part-time smuggler in Kurdish Iraq is making $300,000 a month smuggling oil, it's got a lot of goods to sell.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say one other point about understanding the financial models and where this hits the financial system. Much of the money laundering that's going on in the world is going on in the Middle East particularly. It concerns trade-based money laundering. So oil is a commodity, and there are many other commodities that are moved. And therefore, we need to be looking at the front companies through which this money is moved. It's not often in the name of a particular terrorist, but in an organization that they set up to function and move the trade-based money laundering.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook. We are talking about ISIS' billion-dollar terrorist empire and the U.S. efforts to cut ISIS off from all of its money. And you can join our conversation. We're talking with Louise Shelley. She's founding director of the Terrorism Transnational Crime and Corruption Center. And with Colin Clark. He's associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation. And speaking of Twitter, some of the comments we've hearing so far like this. ISIS sounds like the stories my grandmother – sorry. ISIS sounds like the stories my mother-in-law told me of when the Nazis took over Austria. On our website, the question being raised – isn't the lower price of oil something that's going to hurt ISIS? Interesting question that I would like to touch on in a moment. But first, I want to listen to something that the Treasury Undersecretary David Cohen said back in October. His job, basically, at the Treasury is to work the terrorism and financial intelligence desk and to figure out how to shut down the finances of our terrorist enemies. Here's what he said is ahead for us.
Our efforts to combat its financing will take time. We have no silver bullet, no secret weapon to empty ISIL's coffers overnight. This will be a sustained fight, and we are in the early stages.
Colin Clark, early stages, does that sound about right to you?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, if this were a basketball game, we'd be in the first quarter. The U.S. strategy and that of our allies should be comprehensive in nature. It should be primarily focused on disrupting ISIS's revenue streams, restricting ISIS's access to the international financial system, and targeting the leaders, facilitators, and supporters with both a range of kinetic and non-kinetic actions. And I think also enlisting the Iraqi authorities and financial institutions from preventing the group from using bank branches in Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere, and really, you know, working with our allies in the region, working with the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, the Emiratis, as well as our more traditional allies like the Europeans, Israelis, Aussies, et cetera.
Let's bring in Ruben from Katamit, Massachusetts. Ruben, welcome to On Point.
Hi. My question kind of goes to that point. In all of the discussions I've heard about the money laundering, the smuggling, and everything that ISIS is doing, I'm surprised. Why haven't I heard anybody mention Turkey? You know, in the early part of this conflict, it was obvious that Turkey and the U.S. had conflicting aims. You know, we didn't want to remove Assad. Turkey did. And there was a disconnect between us. And in the meanwhile, all the fighters seem to be coming through Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
All the oil and stuff seem to be going through Turkey. And not just now, you mentioned all the countries in that area, but Turkey has never come up.
Interesting point, Ruben. Let me bring that to Louise Shelley, because I wanted to keep going with this topic of where do we go with our allies on this? Where's Turkey in it, Louise?
It's a very complex question. It's certainly true that a lot of the oil is being smuggled to eastern Turkey. And those are long-term smuggling routes, and they've been functioning for a long time, and there's not been much being done to cut them off. And another problem is that with all the internal conflicts within Turkey, there has been a diminution of the power of the organized crime policing in Turkey. All the police in that division were fired and have to take loyalty oaths to the new government. And so I don't think we're getting the level of support from Turkey in cutting off the oil that needs to be done. And we also need to be talking to the Maliki government, which has not been paying the Kurdish government for months for the oil that is being sold. And some of that is going on, but there is a temptation to engage in oil smuggling when the bills are not being paid and the money isn't coming to maintain the government. So these are two key areas that we need to be looking at in order to be cutting back on the oil smuggling.
Thanks very much for your call, Ruben. Let's bring in Chris from Nashville. Chris, welcome to On Point.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're good.
The reason I was calling was because the lowering gas prices, like it sounds like somebody else thought of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to get to it. Thank you.
I know that ISIS has multiple revenue streams, but, I mean, if they have, they do a lot of gas smuggling and black markets. Well, if oil prices are going down, there generally aren't black markets for things that are inexpensive. And so I think that maybe is there like an idea to make the gas prices continue to go down, which would help cut off their revenue streams?
Colin Clark, want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. And I think prior to gas prices being low, we knew that we saw some European oil companies with the knowledge of European governments and worried about kind of continuing Russian unreliability to have purchased oil through proxies at dumping prices. And until the oil fields are completely recaptured, international companies should be prohibited from buying crude oil through middlemen. But, you know, I'd say two things. One, gas prices are unlikely to remain low forever. You know, I'm not an energy analyst, but we've seen these kind of market perturbations before. And the other is that we've talked about throughout the show that the group's got such a diversified portfolio of how it makes money. So even while we're putting a dent in ICE's main moneymaker, there is this other range of activities that the group calls upon, from fraud to armed robbery, theft, kidnapping for ransom, extortion and protection, and some of the other things that Louise mentioned, the sale of counterfeit cigarettes, of pharmaceuticals,
Counterfeit cigarettes really that big a source of revenue? And then also the other one that was mentioned, Louise mentioned, was selling passports. Is there that much money in that, or is that chump change?
It's unsurprising that cigarettes bring in a significant amount of money. Mm-hmm. I think cigarette smuggling's increased. Black market antiquities has increased. And we've seen other groups as well, or terrorist groups like Hezbollah, groups like Hamas, making large chunks of change from the sale of untaxed cigarettes, as well as groups in the Balkans. So believe it or not, it does bring in a lot of money, particularly when you think of how much it costs sometimes to execute a terrorist attack.
Louise Shelley, we've been paying a lot of attention to ISIS as a culture in the last 4 or 5 months because of the beheadings of their hostages, and the pattern is that they behead those whose countries will not pay ransom. That includes the United States and it includes the British. But it's known that several European countries will negotiate. Is this more about public relations, or is this actually also an important revenue stream for them to trade these lives for cash?
It is a revenue stream. I don't think it's as important a revenue stream as it has been for Aqim, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate in North Africa, which has been largely financed by kidnapping, but it is part of the revenue stream. I wanted to say something about the price of oil as well. Mm-hmm. It's been selling at about $25 to $35 because it is a black market product, so it is still very much under the market price that other countries are selling, so therefore it is attractive. And some of the big producers like Saudi Arabia are not cutting back on production. So the market is not going to rise immediately in price. But I think that they have a competitive advantage, at least in the local economies, of being below market price.
Let's bring Larry from Charleston, South Carolina, into the conversation. Hi, Larry. You're on Point. Welcome.
Thank you. And I'll get right on with it. America has certain aircraft that are really big transport aircraft that have been converted into gunships. We have about 25 or 30 of them. Well, I just put like four of these around any place where we've had cities that have been under besiege for months, all summer, up on the Syrian border, and simply fly, four of them around in circles and continue to fire on them until you destroy everything that you can find with your radar control.
So you're saying military forces as the answer. I want to go to Colin Clark. What about it? I'm sure a lot of people are asking that same question. Is that the solution?
Sure. I mean, airstrikes can help, but they're not a, you heard David Cohen say that we have no silver bullet, and that extends to military force. The kinetic part when countering an insurgency is really only one part and parcel of an overall comprehensive strategy. There's also assuaging grievances of the population. Certainly, the Maliki government's longtime marginalization of Iraqi Sunnis gave rise to the resuscitation of AQI, now ISIS. And so, simply killing and capturing quote unquote bad guys is only going to get you partially the way there.
How are we doing back in Washington in terms of the offices that are trying to fight this? Who is this? Department of Defense and Treasury, basically, Colin?
Again, I think it's a multi-government approach. I think it's DOD. I think it's Treasury. I think the State Department plays a role.
How are they working? How well are they working together?
Probably just as well as usual. I think ISIS
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's good. I mean, you know, it's funny to joke about, you know, kind of intergovernment wrangling, but when the threat, in this respect, I think ISIS has helped us out there because the threat is so severe, you know, that people have really come together to say, whoa, hold on a second. This is something like we've never seen before. This is a dire threat, not only to the region and to the country of Iraq, which we've spent untold blood and treasure in, but this could be a mushrooming threat that could go beyond the region and eventually hit us at home.
I wanted to get a little bit back to the topic of allies, but not so much allies in the region, but Louise Shelley, our allies in Europe, those who could participate with us in looking at the money and tracking the money. Are they with us on this?
I would say in some ways they're more motivated on this issue than we are. Whether they're doing as much, it's not clear, but there is a tremendous interest in Germany of following the money and having a less militaristic approach to this and a more financial approach to this. And Germany is taking a key role in leading the European community on its response to ISIS. So I wouldn't say it's the question of us reaching out to our allies, but our allies having a strong analysis and approach of their own. And there are many debates going on about this in Germany at the moment and much discussion in the press.
We see today that there are reports, Louise Shelley, that ISIS maybe has established a base in Libya, reported by The Guardian out of London. That puts ISIS 450 miles from Italy. Does that change the calculation for Europe on this, or are they, as you're already saying, pretty much Europe-wide already motivated?
I think they're already motivated. I don't think that they have seen ISIS as just a threat in Iraq, but as an enormous concern that we, you know, we have and we share. And for them, the problems of North Africa have been very acute, and people who are following Libya understand that this may be the next Somalia. It's so unstable, and so its proximity to Europe has been a concern ever since the Arab Spring has gone south and brought boatloads of people to Africa, from Africa to Europe, and many other manifestations of terrorism that are affecting the Europeans.
Colin Clark, does ISIS have the advantage that it's territory-based? It really has nowhere to go. It's tied to those oil fields, and it's tied to its ability to extort. And it has the advantage of not having that many options. And looking at us as its enemy, I mean, we our attention span tends to go in election cycles. We have another one coming up. If they just sort of sit and tough it out, do they have the odds of sort of, again, muddling through and staying in control?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an advantage for the group, but I'd also say that it's a vulnerability because the group is fixed. It's in one place. That's an advantage for the United States and the coalition countering the group. I just want to go back and say one thing about you mentioned Libya because the amount of foreign fighters has been a pretty hot topic, and I think it's important. Some estimates peg the number of foreign fighters in Syria and Iraq at around 15,000 from as many as 80 different countries. So I think that really stemming the flow of these fighters, you've got, you know, Saudis, Tunisians, Lebanese, Jordanians, you know, numbering in the hundreds and into the thousands as well. And so that's a point that I think is certainly not lost on the Europeans, the proximity. But getting back to whether or not holding fixed territory is an advantage or a vulnerability, you know, this is a cop-out, but I'd say it's both. And I think much will be determined over these next 6 months to see where the coalition air campaign goes, to see, you know, how much progress the Abadi government makes in Iraq into kind of peeling away some of these aggrieved Sunni Iraqis and really trying to whittle down the core of ISIS to the group's leadership and trying to at least run a cleavage through the group, through different strands of the group.
And Colin, if you were them, you know, it's the business plan for the next 5 years, given all of their realities and their goals. I mean, I'm not asking you to advise them, but if we're talking about them in business terms, if you can wrap it up into a sort of elevator summary, what should they be doing to keep it going?
Yeah, we like to say at RAND that we're not in the business of giving bad men good ideas. But you know, it's a good point. So ISIL depends on this complex management network, or with CFO-like figures at the top. I think it's identifying who the major players are, who in the leadership really serve as the kind of linchpin to the everyday organizations, and really trying to pressure those individuals, if you think about it as a network, kind of removing the key or critical nodes from this network and seeing how the group adapts after that.
All right. Well, so much to watch on this. Colin Clark, Associate Political Scientist at the RAND Corporation, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Louise Shelley, author of Dirty Entanglements, Corruption, Crime, and Terrorism, thank you as well for joining us on Point.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks to everybody who participated, including all of the great questions from all the callers. Coming up tomorrow, White Privilege, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, and America's Complicated Conversation on Race. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.